Welcome back to the Byland Podcast. My name is Emery. Thank you so much for being here and welcome to Better Backpacking. This is episode 153 and my guest today is Andrew Skirka. If you are into backpacking and you've done any research or reading about backpacking on the internet, you've probably come across Andrew at least a few times. He's a highly experienced long-distance backpacker with trips like the Great Western Loop, the Sea to Sea route, and this big Alaska-Yukon expedition under his belt. Those three trails or expeditions alone total almost 20,000 miles, and there's a lot more ground that he's covered. So yeah, he knows a thing or two about backpacking. It's also worth mentioning that Andrew was doing this stuff long before thru-hiking was ever as popular as it is now. These days, Andrew serves as a wilderness guide and an educator with trips ranging from beginner backpackers to more advanced. So if you are into that kind of thing and want to learn how to backpack from someone in person and from one of the best, you'll want to check those trips out that he's offering on his website. Links in the show notes. I always find these types of interviews interesting because I'm curious to find out what goes on in someone's head after all those miles and experiences. Andrew is a very driven and goal-oriented person, but he also understands the flow and the timing of the wilderness. You can't not be driven when undertaking any of those big expeditions that I mentioned, but I think there's this delicate balance between forcing your will upon nature and being driven and driving through hard times and knowing when to stop and observe a situation before it becomes unmanageable, if that makes sense. Andrew has been able to find that balance and now spends his time teaching that balance to others in the backcountry so they can go off and have adventures of their own. I promise I won't spoil the episode, but there are a few really great nuggets of wisdom in this conversation from Andrew that he just casually slips into the conversation like it's nothing, when in reality, I think it's a pretty big deal. If you do happen to catch him, as I did, and you have any thoughts or feedbacks of your own related to that, I would love to hear about it. So be sure to shoot me an email at emery@byland.co. I'd love to hear about it. If you like backpacking and you love hearing from someone who really knows what they're talking about, you're going to enjoy this episode. Before we dive in, if you like this podcast and what I'm doing with Byland and feel like you want to support me and the show, you can do that in a few ways. First, one of the best things you can do is just share it with a friend or someone you know who might enjoy it. Secondly, you can leave me a review and a rating on your podcast player. That really helps let people know what the show's about, and it helps the players kind of promote it internally inside the system. And third, you can donate to the show through a link in the show notes where 100% of those donations will go right back into Byland and keeping everything going. I think of this as more of a tip, if you will. So if you happen to enjoy an episode and you like it, you know, leave a tip for the episode. That'd be great. There is a lot that goes into producing a podcast. So anything that you guys can do to donate and support me, it will go right back into making sure I keep doing this for a long time. One of my goals with this fundraising and the idea of tips and, you know, having the audience support me is to be able to hire an editor so I can publish even more episodes, because right now it's all me and I have a lot going on. So it takes a lot of effort to get these things out, and I'd like to start bringing people in so they can be a little more consistent. To those that have already donated, shared episodes, and left reviews, thanks. I really, really appreciate it. It means a lot to me. I cannot thank you enough. Last but not least, if you're new to backpacking, I have a beginner backpacking course called Learn How to Backpack that's designed to fast track your knowledge and get you up to speed quickly with backpacking. It's completely online, very affordable. So if you're interested in learning more, there's a link in the show notes, or you can just shoot me an email at emery@byland.co. I'd be happy to answer any questions you have. That's it for me. Please enjoy this episode with Andrew Skirka. So you're kind of well known in the industry, I suppose, but in case anyone doesn't know, the things I know about you, like if you look at your Instagram, you're into backpacking, do a little bit of that, do a little guiding, and you have some cats.
Yeah, that's a good summary. Yeah, I backpack, I run, I've got two cats. My wife, Amanda, sometimes makes the channel too. Yeah.
I actually don't know the full-fledged backstory on like how in the world do you, dude, you have put in a bunch of miles across a lot of different states and whatever's. How in the world did you get into that and then to where you are now? Like what, where does it all start and stem from?
Yeah, that's a fair question because it's actually kind of a long history at this point. I've been, did my first thru hike in 2002. So I was still that's in college.
Like, okay.
Yeah, it was the Appalachian Trail.
And where was thru hiking at in the, because today,
dark people, ages.
We are very spoiled.
It was in the dark ages.
That. Yeah.
Let me give you, let me actually tell you how in the dark ages it was.
I would love it.
Still. There was, so there was no like, the information sharing was purely through the shelter journals.
Yeah.
Because there was no like, there's no text messaging. There's no like, you know, far out guide. There was, there was no blogging. But there was, and then word of mouth too. And like, and I remember multiple people were telling me about this, these two guys who had Go Light packs. And like, they were like known because they had Go Light packs. And everyone had kind of heard of these Go Light packs, but no one had actually seen one before. So I finally ran into these guys. They were known as the Trees. They were like 6'2", 6'3", really wiry. And they had Go Light Gust backpacks, which weighed 20 ounces each. Okay. No side pockets, minimal hip belt, maybe even no hip, I think actually no hip belt. No external like pocket on like the front of the packs, mm-hmm. like a shove it pocket. And they had apparently done some, they were like really dialed unlike a lot of Appalachian Trail hikers. Cause they had done some miles in the Pacific Crest Trail, which for someone like myself, like they might as well have like walked across China. Cause it was like at that time in my life, yeah. It was that foreign. Like that there's actually this other trail called the Pacific Crest Trail.
I assume that you grew up on the East Coast or
grew up on the East Coast. Okay. Yeah. Did it really take that long for it to come off? So, grew up in Southeastern Mass.
So was the AT,
went to school in North Carolina.
Okay.
Spent two summers working, pretty close to the Blue Ridge, Blue Ridge Parkway.
So the AT is like in your vernacular growing up ish.
Yeah. I remember my dad would take me to go like day hike Mount Washington and we would run into thru hikers. And my dad would kind of whisper like, you know, those guys, I asked them, they've walked all the way from Georgia. And there's in the Mount Washington summit, the summit building, there's a map of the Appalachian Trail, which is just, I actually have a copy of it. It's a big wall map.
Yeah.
It's kind of a classic map. And, you know, there's like a little star on Mount Washington where you are. So you see these thru hikers who have come through all the way from Georgia. It's pretty wild.
What was that like seeing those guys?
Well, I was young. I don't remember it that well. I think it was just difficult for me to even comprehend. So. Yeah. Yeah, I'm 12 and my dad tells me these guys walked from Georgia. I'm like,
you're like, wow, cool story, Dad.
Sounds long.
I don't know where Georgia's at.
Yeah, like yeah, I've never been to Georgia either. Yeah. So that was 2002. Like, what else about the AT? So I remember, so ultralight backpacking was just getting going. Like GoLight was founded in 1999. GoLight was inspired by the principles of Ray Jardine, who had been sort of refining his kit through the 90s. And GoLight was I think you could argue was like the first lightweight backpacking company.
Yeah.
It has since, it's no longer in business. And there's this healthy cottage industry that make all these like super, like just, like, we just have a bounty of amazing equipment nowadays.
And they keep popping up all over the place.
Yeah, it's, you know, there's not that much overhead to start sewing your own packs. Yeah. Yeah, it's true. Yeah, they just a lot of hobbyists in the industry, which is great because it's led to a lot of innovation.
Yep.
And I think it's natural, like if you look at the players who have been in for a long time, so say like, you know, Ron Bell at Mountain Laurel Designs or Henry Shires at Tarp Tent or, you know, Ron Moog, Six Moon Designs. These guys have been doing it for 20 years now too. Mm-hmm. So it's natural to kind of get a little stale and where you focus a little bit more on just the operations and, hey, it worked well for us last year. Let's just do it again this year. And, mm-hmm. but you kind of maybe stop innovating a little bit.
Yeah. So the trees.
Yeah. So the trees. So I ran into the trees, and like saw these Golite packs, was just blown away. Cause at the time I was carrying a Mountain Smith Frostfire 4,500, which weighed 7.5 or 8 pounds empty. And backpacking at the time was, you know, very mountaineering inspired.
Yeah.
So the lightest sleeping pad you could get, it was a Therm-a-Rest ultralight. It was like a 3/4 length, or maybe even like a 2/3. It's actually like a, they call it 3/4 length, but if you do the dimensions on it, it's actually 2/3. And it weighed it weighed 16 ounces. And that was like, that was groundbreaking. It was it was 1 inch thick. It was not exactly, not exactly,
compact
the feather mattresses that we have nowadays. I remember the first time I saw an alcohol stove. He was a pretty resourceful thru hiker, you know, pretty budget constrained, and he had taken a pop can or like a beer can and basically just squashed it with his, like, he like stomped on it. And he would just pour alcohol into the pop can and just light it on fire and cook his meal over it. And he would put his, he would hold up the pot by like, he take stakes and bang stakes into the ground and then like use the stakes as a pot support. And meanwhile, I'm using a...
Yeah. Were you on trail when you saw this?
Yeah. I was on the Appalachian Trail. Yeah. Yeah. And I was using a MSR Whisperlite stove, which is like, you know, probably at the time, like still probably the most popular stove, among AT hikers. Yeah, it was wild. It was totally wild.
And how old were you when you were on the AT?
I think I had just turned 21.
Okay. Yeah. And the knowledge, like did you have an idea of what to expect when you first got into it? Like, what was your backpacking experience leading into the AT? Was it like
thin? But the difference between having little experience back then and having little experience right now is that back then it was much more difficult to find good information.
Yeah.
So you ended up having to learn a lot of things just the hard way, just because you couldn't find good information. Like, you didn't know the people, or there wasn't a book, the information in Backpacker Magazine was written by some old crusty Knowles instructor who had been backpacking the same way since 1970. And nowadays, just the transfer of information through the internet is, I mean, it's just revolutionized anything. Like I see this all the time with the guiding program that I have, where I will get someone who applies who has very little experience, but they show up with this kit that is slicker than mine by far. Yeah. It's like someone who's never backpacked before does their homework and shows up with a base weight of 12 pounds.
Now they
or
just
10 pounds. Cause they did a bunch of reading on Reddit Ultralight and Backpacking Light. And they read a few, maybe they read my gear guide, and then they took out their credit card and went over to Z-Packs and went over to HMG and just went over to MLD and REI and man, look at that kit. Yeah.
Is that kind of strange to, I mean, it's gotta be interesting at a very least to have your background, know what thru hiking was, or let's say light, just general lightweight backpacking used to be, and how difficult of a road that was, and see the transition, and then to see hikers show up and be like, huh, like do how
quickly I think it's great.
It's awesome. It's got to be
Great. I think it's great. Yeah.
I mean, because you don't want them to have the big, long, arduous. I can't imagine.
I need you to spend
the next 10 years, you know, grunting it out, right?
Yeah. You need to spend 2,000 miles like I did suffering. So when you get to the end, you might know how to backpack. No, that sounds terrible.
That sounds silly.
It's a good thing I was so stubborn at that age, because I would have quit.
Yeah.
It was hard. It was real. It was way, like, of course it's hard. It was unnecessarily hard the way I was doing it. Because I had so much to learn.
Was it that you had a lot to learn, or that was it a mixture between had a lot to learn, but also availability of gear that made your life easier?
Both of that. So by the time I was done, none of the equipment that I was carrying is what I had started with. So I was able to get I picked up a Mountain Smith Ghost, which weighed, I think that weighed about 3 pounds. That was pretty revolutionary. And it actually had like a reasonable hip belt on it. I picked up a bivy sack and got rid of my Sierra Designs clip flashlight tent. I swapped to a MSR pocket rocket, like the original pocket rocket. And then I just got rid of a bunch of things too. Yeah. You know, I remember I still have a copy of my gear list and a spreadsheet from the Appalachian Trail, but I think I started with like a 2 liter pot and a 1.5 liter pot and a bowl
just in case.
and a fork and a knife and a spoon and enough white gas fuel probably to last me to like Harper's Ferry, West Virginia. Cause I like, it was a combination again of like gear, but then I also didn't know skills. So, I didn't know how to measure. I didn't know how to measure how many miles I might be hiking based on time. Like, cause I didn't know pace. Right. It didn't dawn on me until I saw another hiker do it that maybe at the bottom of a big climb, you know, throw down a liter of water while you're sitting there at the creek and then carry a liter to go rather than carrying 2 liters on your back. You know, and it's like, well, it's like the weight is kind of the same, but it's much better to have a liter of water in your belly doing things.
It's almost a strategy. Like you're almost talking like it's technique, but it's almost strategy on that. Like loading up, get the water in you, and then you can carry less water.
It's a combination of gear and skills.
Yeah.
And I started off the Appalachian Trail with low level of, or a poor assortment of both.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Do you remember do you recall when you finished the AT, what that experience was like? Cause I would imagine that, I mean, this isn't a very popular thing that people are doing. It's not as well known, but you just did it at like 21.
Yeah. Well, but at that point in my life, it was by far and away the most challenging undertaking of my life. Almost the accomplishment I was most proud of. Yep. It represented the single greatest investment, an uninterrupted investment of time and energy up to that point. I mean, I had done notable things in high school and like my early years in college. I was a pretty good runner. So it's like, you know, ran a 421 mile in high school and I was a good student, but none of those things kind of held a candle to hiking the Appalachian Trail.
Have you ever figured out why?
It's still a remarkable thought. Sorry. It's still a remarkable thought. They're like, one step at a time.
Yeah.
A human can walk from Georgia to Maine. It's a long way.
Yeah. Have you figured out why that is? Like I did the PCT and I remember very specifically thinking, I've experienced a lot. You know, I was like in my mid-30s when I did the PCT, and I felt like it was like the first thing in my entire life that I felt like I did. Like I earned it. Like no one could be able to be like, hey, yeah, but it is also a team effort. You know what I mean?
That would be, that's part of it. I think the other thing I always look at is it's uninterrupted.
Yeah, that's a good,
point. You know, other goals in your life. So like, you know, you've got kids. So like, and probably raising good kids is like, if they're good kids, is like, you know, something you're really proud of.
Right.
But in the midst of raising good kids, you also go to work every day where you have other goals, and your husband where you have other goals. And maybe you are on like a, you know, like a social softball team where you have other goals.
Right.
So there are distractions.
Right.
Whereas when you're on a thru hike, it's like you get up and you walk and you go to sleep and then you wake. It's your identity for like multiple months in a row. It's your eating, breathing, living, everything thru hiking. Yeah.
I mean, what you're saying is what a lot of people describe as the one thing that they love about it.
For sure.
What did you say? You used a word. It's like uninterrupted.
Yeah.
Because you're right. Like all we are is interrupted every single day, especially now. Like you can't get through a single workday without being interrupted. Like you don't feel that you get the momentum and then it's gone. The momentum's gone. Whereas it's very rare that you get to spend 5 or 6 months or 4 months or whatever it is just uninterrupted.
Yeah, I've had, there've been a few other times in my life where I've come close to that, where I've like taken all the distractions and put them aside. So like, hey, I'm going to do this. So like when I wrote, the gear guide the first time, like it was a pretty, like I'm going to sit down at this desk and I'm just going to write and I'm going to like, I'm going to work a little bit on other things to at least pay the bills that I have, but I am not focusing on anything else. But even those things haven't come close.
Yeah. Did you get that same feeling from your other trips? Cause I know the list is very long, but the first thing that comes to my mind, I mean, I think I heard your name come up in reference to the Great Western Loop. Is that what it's called?
Mm-hmm, yeah.
Like that was one of the big ones. I was like, holy cow. Okay. Like, that's a lot of time. You're talking about like thousands and thousands of miles in one go.
Mm-hmm.
Did you find that same?
All of them.
Yeah, you found the same
all thing. All of them. Yeah, yeah. So, and then in my particular case, like the sequence of my through hike. So, I did the Appalachian Trail. That was the first one, and then I was still in college at the time, so I kind of had to wrap that up. And then after college, the first big trip that I did was the C2C route, which was 11 months and like 7,800 miles through the winter. And then there's the Great Western Loop. That was in 2007. That was 6,800 miles, 7 months. And then the last big hike was the Alaska Yukon Expedition, which was in 2010. That was 4,700 miles in 6 months. And I felt the same way at the end of all of them, just this huge sense of accomplishment and pride and maybe also to a sense of like, okay, I'm ready for this to be done because there are some other things I want to start doing.
Yeah.
Yeah. There are some through hikers who like hit Katahdin, say, mm-hmm. and like not know what to do, and they just turn around and start walking south. And I've never kind of been one of those where I've always felt like a hike has an end. And you should honor that end. And
oh, interesting.
Even if you don't know exactly what's next, you need to go home and refresh, and you'll be inspired again. You'll be hit by lightning again.
I've never heard anyone phrase it like that. That's really interesting, man.
Yeah.
Well, because otherwise you're on this continual treadmill of like you're just bound. You're just trying to if something's not ended, you don't know where to go after that. Like mm-hmm. you're just like, okay, yeah. Well, but if you just put the ending there, then you're like, cool. Now I and a jumping off point.
Yeah.
But you strike me as someone that's always kind of like looking ahead anyhow. Like,
yeah. I think there's a difference in personal style too. Like I tend to be a more goal oriented person. Yeah. So
you're like, okay, it's time to move on.
Yeah. I'm a pretty bad wanderer.
Do you think that's what lets you the being goal oriented? Like, what was the big Yukon one? You said like
the Alaska Yukon Expedition.
Yeah, that's crazy.
Yeah,
is the goal being goal oriented and not just a wanderer? Like, does that let you push and be like, no, I'm going to get this thing done because I have to. I need to meet this goal.
I think so. I think that having helps. I think having the goal, like, I firmly believe that it's the journey and not the end.
Right.
But
exactly.
Having an end and defining success as finishing ensures that you experience that full journey.
Yeah, this is something I've been actually thinking about lately, and like the through hiking culture. I've heard I haven't been on the trail for a while, but I keep hearing these like people talking about the mentality of people going into these hikes, and I wonder if it's like tainting them. And I don't know where I mean, everyone's individual. I don't know if they're like, it's too like the goal of getting to the terminus is tainting the experience because it is about the experience, but it's also about the journey and the goal and all this different stuff. And I never know where I land on it because I think it's all individual, but you're right. If you don't have that like carrot hanging out there,
mm-hmm.
then you don't know where you're going. Like, you have nothing to get you up in the morning to be like, I need to get up and I need to move all day long because that's where, and then to your point, that's where the experience comes in. Because if you're just in town all the time, that's an experience, I guess, but it's interesting.
Yeah. But you might shortchange yourself. Like, and again, I think you're right in that it is individualistic. My thought always has been that, you know, through hiking is kind of like van life, where it looks really good on
Instagram. Super sexy.
Looks really good on Instagram. Like, whoo-hoo. Like scrolling through that feed when you're at work, epic. You're like, get me out of here. Man, I am not living my life to its full potential.
Yeah.
But then you get out there and you're like, man, this is hard.
This is stupid.
My everything about me hurts. I am dirty. I was thirsty today. I'm constantly hungry. I'm sunburned. The mosquitoes won't leave me alone. You know, the last 4 days have been through trees with no views. It's been raining, you know, whatever it is, but it's generally hard. Like it's
definitely not easy.
And you know, if you don't have, I think it's if you're just not committed to finishing, I think there'd be a lot of points along the way where you're like, you know, I'm not ready to dig deeper.
Yeah.
To go that extra level. Yeah. But I think when you go that extra level, that's where it gets particularly meaningful.
Do you identify yourself as like an educator primarily or like a guide? Like, where are you at on that scale, you think?
So I would say, like more of an educator. I'm an outdoor educator. At least in spirit and like what I do.
Okay.
I don't think that the public interpretation of outdoor educator has quite the same cliche probably as a guide.
Okay.
And
like, guide's a heavier word for people to wrap around.
I mean, someone who's a guide, that's kind of serious, right? Like an outdoor educator is like,
here's a mushroom.
Could be 22 years old and fresh out of college and has barely done more backpacking than you, but they're...
Guides have weathered hands and...
Yeah, and wrinkled and like, you know, crow's feet in their eyes and and they, you know, and you see them at the bar afterwards and they're just so cool, right?
Yeah.
So, you know, I've always described my business as a guide service, but it has a heavy of enough educational tilt that I could probably recategorize it as a school and or an academy or something, and it would be perfectly appropriate.
How long have you been doing this guiding thing?
Started guiding on my own in 2011. And when I finished up, and you could maybe relate to this because you've got a through hiking history, but in my 20s, I was just this like prolific, like dirtbag through hiker.
Awesome.
It was really good. And whenever I talk to a young person and they're like, I don't know what I want to do. I have these like itches to go travel and explore and go find myself, but my parents and my teachers and my neighbors and my aunts and uncles are all telling me that I need to go get a job and become an adult. I'm like, look, kid, you got plenty of time to become an adult. If you've got that itch, go scratch it, go make it happen. And remember, if you're financially independent and you don't need that much income to be financially independent, if you're really good with your finances,
right,
they have no leverage over you.
Yeah.
So they can tell you how disappointed they are in you, but they have no leverage. So,
right.
So in my 20s, I did that. I dirtbag through hiker. I hiked all the time. It was just basically, I would do one hike. I'd come back. I'd figure out how to make a little bit of money. I'd go back out for another one. But living out of plastic totes and changing my address every, you know, like a couple times a year and crashing at my parents' house when I was kind of between things on occasion and not even owning like a set of sheets. And having every girlfriend that I ever had always had like an expiration date on it. Cause it was like, hey, I'm in town through March 7th. And if that, I already have my planes, my plane tickets booked. I'm going down to Arizona to start the Great Western Loop. And that just, that lifestyle maybe kind of got old, felt like it had a little bit of an expiration date on it. Yeah. I mean, I think there's a reason why you don't see like a lot of like 50-year-old lifties and like at a Colorado ski mountain, right? Like just that lifestyle just kind of,
It
just gets a little old, just gets a little taxing. Yeah. I mean, at some point you kind of want, maybe you either want other life experiences or maybe just some, maybe some comforts. Yeah. So some material comforts, which is, so before my Alaska trip, I was like, hey, go do this Alaska trip and, you know, come back and maybe there'll be some opportunities for you to maybe level up the profession, your professionalism. But if not, like, if you just feel like you're still hustling, if you're still agreeing to fly to, you know, St. Louis, Missouri for, because they're willing to pay you $300 and you figured out that the flight was only going to be $200 and you could stay at a $50 a night motel. Maybe just go get a real job. So I got back and I seemed like people were really interested in that trip. So I thought I would try to kind of float some trial balloons with utilize the credibility that I built up. So yeah. I offered guided trips on my very primitive website and some people signed up. So that was the beginning. But I had, I learned a lot in those first trips. Like the first trip that I ran, it was my original thought with the guide service was that I would run trips in sort of the style of my travel. So we would go to places that I love to go and we would travel through them like I like to travel. So like fast and light and do like really adventurous routes. And the first group though, I realized very quickly that like these guys just needed basic backpacking skills. Like they didn't know how to really read. They didn't know how to read maps that well. They didn't know how to use a compass. They weren't fit enough to do 20 miles in a day or 4,000 vertical feet, and their gear needed work. So that's when I kind of pivoted. And like the following year, I started offering not just like, 7-day or 14-day trips to like, the High Sierra or Alaska, but I was offering 3-day intro level, learn how to backpack courses. And those courses felt like that mission, that like this idea that I could create a program where I could teach people how to backpack better, that I found really, that was up my alley. That felt good. I think that first summer I thought like, well, maybe it would be like this kind of this high end, very like service oriented outfit. But no, what I really want to do is bring people in and teach them. That was rewarding. I didn't want to do tours.
Yeah, that's definitely a split, right? Like, all right, you're here, I'm going to show you this area, but then like there's the other side of like people do need help. You had at this point so many miles and you had to have been so dialed in with like, this is how I backpack. Like to your point, that's how it all started out. When you started seeing people come in who needed just basic backpacking skills, was it kind of hard to... What was it like shifting your mindset into like, wait a second, you don't know how to like your backpack's all cattywampus? Or, I mean, we've all seen, I went backpacking with a girl one time that I just assumed you knew, like everyone knew that the waist belt needs to be buckled. And it wasn't buckled for like miles and miles. And I was like, and this was really early on in my backpacking experiences. And
I guess, she didn't make it to the status of wife.
No. She was the wife of someone else. So I was just like, holy cow, that's wild. There's a lot of people that this stuff doesn't come naturally. So what was that like, seeing, having to shift your mind into educator versus tour guide?
That was a big adjustment. Yeah, I think I'm exaggerating a little bit, but I think some of those early trips that I ran, especially the longer ones where we were, like say in like Sequoia Kings Canyon National Park and they were week long trips. I think it's fair to say that maybe the trips were still, they're still Andrew's trips and everyone else was along for the ride. Yeah.
Okay.
So, but there was this transition where I needed to, because being a good backpacker does not make you a good guide. And it does not make you a good teacher.
Yeah.
So those are two like totally different skill sets that I needed to develop. So, you know, I've spent a lot of time guiding now. I think, I don't remember where I was at the end of last year. I think I've spent something like 15 months of my life guiding.
Wow.
Which is, yeah, it's like over a year. So I spent a lot of days in the field with clients, and I think that, you know, when I go into a trip, I am in a 100% state of service.
Yeah.
My goals are their goals. It's not my trip, it's their trip. And I want, like, the first night of a trip, I usually, like, and this is the way I instruct and sort of tell all my guides to do it too, like, go around that group at night, like, you know, the metaphorical campfire. Even if you're not having one, and say like, hey, I want to know everybody's goals for this trip. We're going to be out here for 3 days or 5 days or 7 days or 11 days. What are, like, you spent a bunch of money to be here. You bought a plane ticket. You got a rental car. You bought all this trick equipment. Yeah. Why are you here? And then over the course of the trip, the goal is to make sure that we, you know, our goal is to make sure that their goals are accomplished. For an intro level group, you know, a lot of them, like, you know, we often end up with like folks who have never ever gone backpacking, which is awesome.
Yeah.
Right. So like, so their concerns are like, I want to learn how to sleep well out here. I want to learn how to read a map. I want to learn how to make breakfast and dinners that don't come out of a mountain house packet. Right. And then whereas a more advanced group, so suppose like, you know, alumni who have been on multiple trips with us before, or even, you know, we get them are like through hikers who want to, like, you know, look at a location like Alaska and they're like, nope, can't do that alone. Mm-hmm. So they buy in and their goals are different. Their goals are, I want to learn how to follow caribou trails, or I want to learn how to ford big rivers, or I want to learn how to navigate across, you know, muskeg, you know, whatever it might be. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So, and then,
interesting.
Yeah. So, but it was a big transition. It was, it took me a while and like, not just like a few trips, but like, I'd say a few years to really just embrace being a guide and leaving and like checking my self-interest at the door. Yeah.
I think you mentioned like what did you say your mile was back in the day? You're very quick individual, right? Like you probably have a high motor on you. Was it difficult to kind of gear yourself down to those, like, okay, like you said, this is no longer Andrew's trip, this is their trip, and I'm going to be of service? Or was that all you needed, was like just a flip of, oh, okay, it's actually about them? And
I think that there was, so even when I embraced the it's about them, not me attitude, there is still this still a missing piece of not being fully aware of what they were capable of, and always being maybe a little bit too optimistic about what they like. So I would always kind of think like, well, like, you know, hey, it's 2 o'clock in the afternoon. Like, let's do this. Let's do one more pass. We got, you know, we got time. But, you know, I learned on a number of occasions that, that I need to be in better tune with, because, and then here's the other thing that'll happen. You'll get them in a group and you'll be like, hey guys, it's 2 o'clock in the afternoon.
I feel like you've had this conversation
before. We can do this one more pass, and I haven't been on it before, but it looks awesome. And then at the other side, you will have to drop down like a couple thousand vertical feet, but look at this lake where we could camp. And who in a group setting is going to go, no, yeah, Andrew, I think that's a dumb idea. I'm tired. And I think that, I think we should probably just call it here for the day.
Yeah.
By the way, a neat trick for getting around that, like, so that, like, that peer pressure situation, we use this all the time. I will present to a group their options. So I'll give like a, you know, an option A, an option B, maybe an option C. I will give them the opportunity to ask questions about each option just so that they can kind of wrap their mind around each option a little bit better. And then I will do a blind vote where I have them all close their eyes and give me like a, like a, like hold up number one or two fingers or three fingers to tell me what they're, how they're feeling. Or I might even just do like a check-in, like a temperature check. Okay. And I'll say like, give me thumbs up if you are feeling like a rock star and you could do whatever we've done already and do it again. Give me like thumbs horizontal if you are feeling like, you know, it's already been a good day, but you've got some energy left. And give me a thumbs down if you feel like just you need to camp at the next spot. And people will be really honest with you when all the eyes are closed. Interesting. And you always need to make, not always, you should, when possible, you should always accommodate the person who's struggling the most.
Yeah.
It's really unfair to ask someone who's already struggling to then struggle more. And sometimes it's necessary because you're like, hey, Bob, or hey, Sue, like, you know, we can't camp here. We need to go a little bit further. You know, what can I do to make the next hour of your life better? But it's not really an option to stop here. So sometimes you need to do that. But if you can stop and someone's wanting to stop, you should just do that. And if there are people who have all the energy in the world, then point them at the next closest mountain and say, hey guys, let's do a side trip before dinner. Who wants to go?
That's a lot of social navigation. I mean,
oh yeah. Yeah. But that's a guide. Yeah.
Yeah. You're responsible for a lot of happiness. You're responsible for your own reputation because it's a business. Mm-hmm. And you have to take care of their why, right? Like, why are they out there?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
When you get to know these clients, is there like a commonality as to like why they want to do this stuff? Like why they're interested in getting out there? Have you been able to kind of whittle it down to a general?
We see a huge range. So, because we're offering trips, we're offering, say, like, you know, 3-day trips for like for beginner backpackers or like never ever backpackers, all the way up to like 11 days in the Brooks Range of Alaska.
Yeah.
So it's a pretty huge spectrum of experience levels and what people are wanting to get out of it. We all also offer trips of a pretty wide range of fitness levels. So all of our trips are given a fitness level. And we've got 5 of them. So there's basic, moderate, median, high, and ultra. And like a basic group, you know, they're going to be limited with how many miles or how many vertical feet they can go. And the physical part of their experience, like typically they like to push themselves, but they also are out there for the camaraderie and the experience of being out there and being present in a place, kind of a little bit more camping oriented. And then on the opposite end of the spectrum, you've got like folks who are in like this ultra category, and they literally are like ultra runners and triathletes and like hardcore through hikers. And probably 75% of the conversations are about like what's on their Strava feed. So it's two totally different audiences.
Yeah. That's interesting, man. Yeah. But at least you can bucket these people into you generally know their why based on the bucket that they end up in.
Exactly. Yeah. So we have a pretty thorough application form. Yeah. It's a lot more than just like, what's your name and address and give us your credit card. So we ask, like about their backpacking history, and we ask what they do for their fitness on a weekly basis. And we ask for how many vertical feet and how many miles they can sustainably do every day. And what their comfort is on class 3 terrain, like class 3 scrambling, and what their BMI is, and what their fitness is relative to their peers, and like what their goals are. And so we ask a lot of questions that kind of help us group them with other people that are like them.
Yeah. That's awesome.
Yeah.
Good for you, man. That's that's legit. I mean,
it's a good system because the alternative doesn't work.
Yeah. No kidding. Right.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, everyone's been in a group before, right? Yeah. Where you've either been the fast person or the slow person, and either way, you're not having a great time.
Right. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Can I ask you about high routes?
Yeah, let's do it.
Can you educate me on them?
Sure.
It's kind of I understand what they are, but I'll be honest with you. It's a word that I hear tossed around generally in reference to maybe the Sierra Range or something like that. But I honestly have no idea where it came from or like what exactly it is and what it's defined as. So
okay.
Can you kind of educate me and everyone else on?
Yeah. So a high route, I think you could loosely define it as a non-technical backpacking route. So that would be something up to like class 3 travel. Okay. But that is primarily a backpacking route. So like right. The class 3 and maybe even like some low class 4, so long as it's like technically easy.
What's the class of, how's this, the scramble?
Class three would be hands and feet required, but low consequences of fall and probably low fall risk too.
Okay.
Class 4 would be not necessarily difficult climbing, still scrambling, but consequences of a fall would be more significant, possibly fatal. It's kind of where the beginning of where you might have some roped travel.
Okay. Yeah.
Yeah.
Gotcha. Okay.
So I would say like in the case of a high route, like you shouldn't be doing like hard class 4, but I would say like maybe easy scrambling that maybe has some exposure that might be in play if sort of the terrain requires it, but it wouldn't be the first. It wouldn't be your first choice. You wouldn't be like, you wouldn't go seek out that terrain if there was something easier.
Right.
But a high route generally is going to follow. It's going to follow some sort of geographic feature. So suppose like the Continental Divide or the watershed boundary between like two major rivers. So say like the Continental Divide would be say like in the Wind River Range or in the Colorado Front Range, like Rocky Mountain and Indian Peaks Wilderness. Yeah. And then a watershed divide would be something like, say, the Kings River in California or the Merced and Tuolumne rivers the Merced and Tuolumne rivers in Yosemite. Or the Sierra Crest, which starts way down in... I guess like Walker Pass. I guess actually you could say it's the Pacific Crest Trail. The Pacific Crest is the same thing as the Sierra Crest, but the Sierra Crest would be a subpart of that.
Okay.
So it's following. So that's and you're staying as high as you possibly can along this feature, without getting into technical terrain, and while also trying to optimize the sort of backpacking aesthetic. So it's not necessarily a rule that if there's a higher route that it's necessarily the best route, but that tends to be where you want to go. So if there's a viable higher route, there better be a damn good reason why the route isn't up there.
Right. Okay. this is interesting. See, I never knew that this was like even the definition of like what the parameters are of this thing.
Yeah.
I can see the lure of it.
Yeah.
Because it's you got to really put a lot of skill sets into this thing.
Well, particularly for developing it. But then, so there are, I think, five, actually, how many are there at this point? Maybe 6, 7, 8 high routes. The Sierra High Route was first. It was developed by Steve Roper, who's a climber, like a very accomplished climber in the Sierra. And he's got this great book. It was published by Mountaineers Press. It's called, it's got on my bookshelf. What is it called? It's the title is actually not the Sierra High Route. That's the, or it's called Sierra High Route Traversing Timberline Country. So that was Steve Roper. And so he was, I think you could say maybe he was like the godfather of high routes in North America, in the US. Mm-hmm. And then the concept has been applied to the Wind River Range and to the Colorado Front Range and to like Sequoia Kings Canyon National Park. And I haven't gotten on them, but I understand that there are kind of some developing high routes in the Olympics and in the Cascades. Yeah. and in the, I mean, I think I've seen maybe saw one in the Sawtooth. So like people are kind of like
starting to do it.
Yeah, because it's this.
Is there a length? Is there?
Nope. It's geographically defined.
Okay. Oh. Okay.
So you don't, there doesn't, there's no like set minimum or maximum for high route because you, the route goes for as long as that boundary or that feature exists.
Fascinating.
And it should end where the geography sort of naturally wants it to end. So as an example, the Fifthner Traverse runs from Milner Pass in Rocky Mountain National Park to Berthoud Pass at the south end of James Peak Wilderness. And those two, it starts and ends there because that entire stretch is roadless. If you look north and south there, if you look north of there, the Cotswold Divide kind of fades and drops down pretty low. Mm-hmm. And it's just kind of not, the quality of the terrain becomes like decidedly like non-high route-esque.
Okay.
And then if you look to the south of the Fifthner Traverse, basically you could just walk the Continental Divide Trail. Yeah. And that's kind of what it would be. So that's where it starts and finishes. And then like the Wind River Range, the Wind River High Route, that's a little bit more difficult because there's a like a logistical consideration in where it starts and finishes too, right? You don't want to just like start arbitrarily in the middle of nowhere just because the geography dictates that. So, but the Wind River High Route, the version that I developed, starts at the Wind River Peak, which is the southernmost 13er in the range. And then it ends at Downs Mountain, the northernmost 13er in the range. And then you have some options for getting to those two termini.
That's super cool. Yeah. How'd you get into this?
Because I didn't have enough time to do, or even interest to take 5 months and go hike another trail. And I was also kind of just done with just following mindless trails that a trail crew had come through and built a trail that a guidebook author had come out and written about. And then that like thousands of other hikers have been on. It just kind of wasn't of interest anymore. But the high routes were this great project for me because it gave me a motivation to go explore really thoroughly these areas that I hadn't sort of been in as much as they would warrant. So like the Fifthner Traverse is a great example where this is just at like the closest trailhead to my house is like 45 minutes away. And I had spent a bunch of time there when I first arrived in Colorado, but then I kind of wandered like other places. Developing the Fifthner Traverse was a great way for me to refamiliarize myself with my backyard. So I would go out for overnights or like one day adventure runs or like, I was also guiding some trips in the park. So it just and it gave me like some places to go explore and go like, hey, should this be part of the route?
And these are, I assume that the definition of a high route would be like no trails, no manicure, no trails.
Yeah, or not maybe not contrived. So I mean, it should follow a trail. It will follow a trail where there's a trail that like, if you were just to like look at the topography and say the route should be here, and then you look at a trail map and you're like, boy, there's a trail that's really close. It should probably just follow that trail.
Yeah. Okay. That makes sense.
I shouldn't like intentionally avoid trails, but usually the places that high route likes to go, it's where sort of building a trail isn't really practical. So, so they tend to be quite a bit off trail. So like, as an example, the Wind River High Route, I think is like 2/3 off trail. And most of the on-trail miles are just getting to the start and getting back to a trailhead after you finish. And like the Kings Canyon High Basin route, that goes like, at one point, I think it goes like 22 miles without touching a trail.
Wow, that's super cool.
Yeah.
When you started doing those, you said you were bored or getting kind of bored with just putting your head down and going on a trail that's manicured. What was that transition like going from I can kind of set it and forget it to, oh, I actually have to start thinking about this. Like, how am I going to navigate this landscape? Was that a different mindset, or were you already prepared for that?
It was thrilling.
Nice. Yeah.
Yeah. Because I've always looked at through hiking or backpacking generally as a skill. It's like, it's something that I want to keep getting better at.
Yeah.
Well, how do you get better at backpacking if you have kind of backpacked in every season and backpacked all these trails and backpacked in all these locations? Like, you know, you're going to plateau with your skill set. But then you read, you know, this guidebook by Steve Roper that says like, hey, I know you've hiked the John Muir Trail before, but check out this Sierra High route and you can go over all these passes that you can maybe see sometimes from the John Muir Trail, and you'd look up and go, hell no, would I ever go over that? And then like, that's when it got fun again.
Yeah.
Cause it was like, it opened up all this terrain that, that was off limits to me previously.
It's fascinating how the journey that people take, it's like, it sounds so, it's obvious, but it's interesting how all of these things just keep leading up to like the next skill set. It's like, if you would have started out with high routes, if someone starts out with high routes, they're probably going to be overwhelmed pretty quickly. I would imagine they could be.
Oh yeah. But it's not. Yeah. Not they're like advanced level. Yeah.
Yeah. But then you take your experience having done all these things and those skills that you have in your quiver. And now you can apply all of those things to these high routes. Like, it's just amazing to me how the backcountry can continue to provide experience. Do you know what I mean? Like,
mm-hmm. I totally know.
And it will present itself when you're, it's almost like the opportunity and the experience reveals itself when it needs to. It's like, you'll get there and then all of a sudden the doors open. It's like, maybe the doors open a little earlier and you're not ready for it. Yeah. But for a lot of times it's this natural progression. Like for me, on a very minor scale, I got into backpacking because I was tired of hunting around a bunch of people. And I just wanted a more wild experience. There was a very specific moment in time where I was like, this is stupid. I'm not doing this anymore. I'm going to start getting a little further from the trail. And so how do I do that? Okay, well, I got to start learning about backpacking. So for me, it was rooted in hunting. Like, how do I have a more organic experience hunting that's free of road noise and that whole world? And literally I started out my backpacking experience being very well equipped off trail. Like, it does not concern me. I'm more than happy to just figure out my way through terrain that is technical, because that's what you do when you're hunting, you're off trails. So when I started learning about backpacking and started learning about how to get better at it, then you start uncovering these different, through hiking. Oh, I've heard of that before. Oh, maybe I'll give that a shot. How are these guys doing this? What do you mean they're hiking for 5 months, 6 months, 25 miles, 30 miles a day, 20 miles a day? Like, who the heck is doing this? Like, how are they doing this? And then it's just revealing. It's like, as you build up your skill set, and then next thing you know, I'm on the PCT and I'm like, what in the world? How did this happen? And it's just interesting to me how this, there's a natural progression as you build your skills and you just continue learning. It just reveals itself to you, and it'll happen when it's time.
You probably have some other examples of that too. Like, you've got kids, so you probably, like, that's another skill set. Yeah. Backpacking with kids. Right.
I would have never done that. Exactly. Mm-hmm. Like, I took, very good point. We took our 9-month-old backpacking 3 miles in, 3 miles out. Didn't want to go anything crazy, but I guarantee someone out there is like, I wouldn't even take my kid hiking.
Yeah. But yeah. And other people, other people push the bounds. They buy a pack raft, or they buy a fat bike, or they
just go for it.
They buy a pair of Alpine touring skis, or they hear some podcast about canyoneering.
Yeah.
And like, all these ways that you can sort of expand backpacking, because backpacking, you know, I think you would agree too, it's like, it's kind of at the root of a lot of backcountry travel.
Yeah. Yeah. That's a good point. Yeah. It's like, that's the base mode of transportation mm-hmm. to a lot yeah. of different things. Like mm-hmm. you can backpack in to go fishing. You can backpack mm-hmm. in to go rock climbing. You can back all the, yeah, it's very yeah. good point. And then now the gear's getting so good, like the pack rafting thing, boom, that's a huge opportunity for a lot of people. And then the biking, like now you see people bike rafting, like or, just like combining all these random skill sets. And you're like, what in the world? This is so
ski,
crazy.
Ski raftineering is another one that I've heard. Yeah.
I'm yeah. like, what are people going to come yeah. up with next? Like, it's so yeah. wild.
Yeah. Like there was a guy up in Alaska, Luke Mel, a couple of years, probably like 5 years ago now, they went into Denali on the north side, okay. climbed Denali with pack rafts and skis, and then sort of climbed down a little bit, skied down all the way down to, they must have somehow managed to get to a large river and then put into their pack rafts in the river and floated out carrying their skis and all their mountaineering equipment and stuff.
That's so gnarly.
Yeah, wild. Totally wild. Yeah.
Do you ever have dreams about doing another big adventure like that? Or do you think it's all...
yeah, that's a good question. I don't have any particular ideas right now. I think it's okay to say too that like life is in chapters. Yeah. So for me now, I'm 41 years old. I'm married. I own a home. I got two cats. I run a business. Like, I think I'm okay with... like I'm learning a lot in my current existence. I'm happy in my current existence. I think if we checked back in 8 years or even maybe even five, maybe it looks pretty different. Maybe I'm like, yeah, like I'm, I needed a change.
Yeah.
Right. I'm actually renovating a home right now. And I was reading this book last night on American architecture. And I just found it so interesting. I was like, man, like, maybe that's like a second career for me or something. Like yeah. I just, yeah. So
interesting.
Yeah. Never known the difference between a gabled and a hipped roof before.
Dude, I think it's yeah. really important to, allow chapters to happen. You've dropped some pretty good wisdom, in the short amount of time that we've been talking. And I think you're right. I think the idea of having like the end point on a trail is really good for you. The idea of allowing yourself to have chapters. I've mentioned this on previous episodes. I feel like there's a chapter that I'm going into that I'm having to let go of previous chapters that I'm now fully embracing like the new chapter of, all right, like I feel like I got really good at backpacking and I understood everything. Not really good, but like, I feel like I leveled up. And I was like, oh, I get it. Like, I can do more. And then, but I really wanted to have a family. And so I had a family. And so I'm like, I was caught in this like vortex of, I came off the PCT. I got married. We had a kid. I was super excited. I was like, this is going to be amazing. And then now I'm having this like chapter marker in your words of like, no. This new chapter is like, I get to show all of this to my kids. And I've been grateful enough to have had those experiences, to be able to have the skill set to then be cool camping and backpacking and taking them hiking and have the confidence knowing that everything's going to be okay. And that's like the new chapter. And now like, do I lay in bed at night sometimes thinking about like, man, the CDT does sound pretty cool. Like that is a trail that like,
don't say that in your sleep while your wife is awake.
Yeah. I'm like, the CDT for some reason has my name on it, but like maybe it happens, maybe it doesn't, but this is the chapter I'm in right now and I'm trying to fully embrace that. So I appreciate the perspective on that. That's really good. Cause yeah. it's really important to allow that to happen.
I think there's something too to be said. The other piece that is, choosing your chapters with a little bit of intention. Mm. Just being aware that your decisions have implications. Yeah. So like, you know, if you decide, for example, to buy a home, you know, that can get difficult to kind of, yeah. you know, to get out from underneath of, right? Or if yeah. Because suddenly if you have a home, it's like, well, I'm stable now. I can go date seriously. And suddenly you meet a woman you really like, you know, or yep. whatever gender you might be in. Suddenly you're married. It's like, okay, well, that's another decision. So I think it's good just to say, like, don't let there's a difference between letting life have its way with you versus maybe taking life by the horns and driving it. Yeah.
Yeah, dude, that's super. That's really valuable.
A little easier said than done, but I think it's.
Well, it's always good to have in the back of your mind. I mean, to have just a little bit of intention behind your actions. And I think that means that falls into a lot of different categories, like intention in the backcountry, like knowing why you're doing a thing, like being aware of stuff. Like all of that applies. Like I'm sure that all of the things that you learned on all these expeditions, you've found those skill sets have applied to like general life. Like,
I wonder how many self-described wanderers have made it this far in this episode. So far, I feel like our conversations all come back to sort of setting goals and being sort of driven. And
yeah. Maybe if you're a self-described wanderer, maybe you need to end a chapter or start a goal or something like that, right? Well, I figured we could just wrap up with what is your advice on approaching gear? I think a lot of people can get overwhelmed with all the inundated with a bunch of stuff, but what's like your core principles?
Let me give you the core principle, because I think that actually, so I think that there is a right way to backpack.
Okay.
It's funny, I actually read on your website that you don't think that there's a right way to backpack. And I was like, I disagree with that. So the right way to backpack is that you should have gear, supplies, and skills that are appropriate for your trip objective and for the conditions that you will likely encounter. So let me break that down a little bit. Mm-hmm. So the gear, supplies, and skills thing is like, everyone kind of knows what those are, but the trip objective, what that's referencing is, it's this why. Why are you going out?
Yep.
And there's a spectrum of backpacking style. And on one end of the spectrum is this, it's a very like camping centric experience. You're not hiking very far. You're not hiking for very long. The destination is more about getting to a spot and doing something else. So like you're big into birding. You're going hunting. You want to just hang out with your friends and play a guitar and write in your journal and take photographs. Whatever it might be. Awesome. Glad you're getting out. The other end of that spectrum is like your classic hard charging through hiker, mm-hmm. where it's all about time on feet and miles and seeing things. So the way that you would approach both of those trips is totally different, right? So your gear, supplies, and skills also need to follow suit. So like when I'm going on a trip with my wife, who is more casual backpacker, we bring a Kindle and I bring an MSR reactor stove, mm-hmm. and I bring a big tent and I bring our warmer sleeping bags and I bring extra fuel. So at night I can heat up a washcloth for her and she can wash her face with a hot washcloth. Okay. Like the opposite is also true, right? Where I'm on my own, I'm like doing one of those like, you know, hard charging overnights, trying to scout a new route or something. I'm going super ultralight. I'm going to compromise on all of my camping comfort. I'm going to carry a tiny little shelter, a sleeping bag that's barely warm enough. A stove that will like only allow me to make dinner. Okay. Et cetera, et cetera. Okay. So that's the objective. And then the conditions, the likely conditions is similar, where you're going to change your gear, supplies, and skills based on the conditions. So you can actually do this like very thorough research project before your trip. And you can predict with reasonable accuracy what you will encounter for temperatures, sort of like highs and lows, precipitation, water availability, biting insects, sun exposure, the walking surface. So that might be like, dirt, granite, snow, natural hazards like high water crossings, lightning, avalanches, flash floods, et cetera, all that stuff. There might be some other environmental factors that I would look at too. I'm kind of... you're not remembering all like 10 of them. And then your supplies and skills follow suit. So if you're going to be backpacking back east, you bring like rain gear. And if you're going to be backpacking in California, maybe you can leave it behind. And if you're going to be in Maine in June, you better make sure you have your insect protection. Whereas if you're in Colorado in August, you're just not going to need it. So that is the, I think that's like the driving principle for gear selection.
Yeah. That's awesome. That I think that's good for people to hear, because I think they get tunnel vision on stuff and they don't allow themselves to, like, they just get so sucked into the idea of a base weight, you know, and they're like, oh, I don't need all that stuff. To hear that from someone like you, that's like, yeah, sometimes I bring a Kindle.
Like, my wife loves it.
Or I bring a larger tent. Like,
yeah,
you're not awesome. You're not enforcing your own, not even like, you're not forcing the mentality of a light and fast mission on a relaxing weekend.
Right. Yeah. In fact, it's counterproductive. Like,
Exactly. That's literally what
you'll fail to accomplish your goals if you go fast and light on a casual weekend. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. You'll get to camp at 4 o'clock and you'll be like, well, what are we going to do now?
Yeah. Yeah. That's awesome. Those are really good. I guess that kind of covers the rapid fire questions on like that indicates like, are you going with a framed pack or a frameless pack? Are you going with a synthetic, you know, or natural stuff? Like depending on the weather and the conditions and where you're at is, you know, you probably have all of those things inside your kit that you adapt accordingly.
Yeah. Within that, I would say, you know, I definitely have my favorite picks. For the folks who are like, well, that's really, you know, that's really a good principle. But what does that mean in reality? When you dig a little bit deeper, I think, you know, I'm usually looking for, my favorite equipment is stuff that tends to have a pretty wide application range. Okay. So I actually don't own a frameless backpack right now, because a frameless backpack really can't properly carry a beer canister, and too many of the locations where I backpack require beer canisters. So it's just not really worth it to me to have a frameless backpack. Mm. And then my shelter of choice is the Mountain Laurel Designs Solo Mid XL. And I love that shelter because you can basically take it into any month in any location and it does okay. Sometimes it's a little heavy. Sometimes it might be a little undergunned, but it's like
flexible.
Yeah. Cause it's modular. It's
okay.
It's light. It's storm worthy. So, if your listeners are kind of like debating between products and they have an option of maybe buying an item that's maybe a little bit more expensive or a little bit heavier, but that just gives them a wider range of options. Like don't take it to an extreme, but like just a little bit marginally, you know, some marginal compromises on some things, then you're probably better off long-term to do it that way. If you're going to do a through hike or something like really long-term, that's super specific, then like, by all means, go in all in on the niche gear.
Yeah. Do synthetic layers? Are you like a merino wool, or I guess the new thing is like alpaca?
I do have an alpaca fleece. It's pretty nice. Yeah. I do both. I think they both have their advantages and disadvantages. Synthetic lasts a lot longer. You can get it into lighter weights. So in a lighter weight fabric is going to be less warm. It's less expensive. I find that the polyesters come a long way, and like the anti-stink treatments that they put on it. Mm. I don't feel like the polyester smells nearly as bad as it did 20 years ago. Whereas wool, you know, wool is not warm when wet. I don't know why they say that. The only time the only time I've been warm when wet is when I piss on myself, and that doesn't last that long.
That must be just like a tagline that they have just been like, it's warm when you're wet, and I'm like, you're definitely not warm.
No.
I don't know if you're colder, but you're definitely not.
You're warmer. Like I will definitely say like a pair of like merino wool socks.
Who's gauging this warmth?
When you're tromping through, Sierra snowmelt in June on the Pacific Crest Trail and you got a pair of merino wool socks, you notice the difference versus polyester. But they are by no, I mean, your feet are still like, you know, feel like bricks and they're totally frozen by the time you get out. So,
well, they also, on the opposite end of that was another tagline. They'll be like, it also keeps you cool when you're really hot. And I'm like, that's also not very true. For me, it's just like, I've stuck with merino wool. Like, it just keeps me back. I feel like I warm up slower and I cool down slower. That's it. Like, yeah. I just feel better in general. Like, there's not crazy temperature swings, but I'm like, I definitely am chilly if it's wet. And I'm definitely hot when it's hot.
Yep. Funny. No, there's a lot of marketing hyperbole in the outdoor industry. I mean, like,
alpaca people are all about putting merino in the can. I tell you what, it is a thing.
That's a nice product. I do like those knitted natural fibers. Like, I'm a big fan. My favorite running hat in the winter, it's kind of looks like one of those like Norwegian sweaters, but a hat form. It's like very like loose. It's like loosely knit alpaca or like coarse wool, like sheep wool. But it breathes so well.
Yeah.
That's but awesome. Somehow, you know, and then all those little hairs kind of prevent a lot of, cut down a lot on the draftiness.
Yeah. I think I think I have highly underestimated the structure of materials and how they're weaved together and parsed, you know,
huge difference.
Like, yeah, I'm just now realizing in the last couple of years of like how important how they put it together.
Yes.
I think people highly underestimate that.
I have a smart wool. It's like it's probably like 180, maybe 200 weight smart wool long sleeve shirt. Mm. And it's from 2008. And I baby it so much because I love it for running in the winter because it's kind of a loosely knit wool. So it has like a lot of the wool properties that you love, but it doesn't have that heaviness that wool usually has. Yep. And the knit or the weave, makes a huge difference in its performance. Huge.
Yeah. And this is stuff that I remember when I was learning all this stuff, I would just go to the store, like a puffy jacket's a puffy jacket. That was in my head. I was like, oh, it's supposed to keep you warm. And then the more you go down the path, you're like, oh no, they're all different. And I don't know. And then eventually you see what it is, but you have to own a couple. At least I had to before I understood, like, oh, that's not a puffy jacket. That was just something that was on the clearance rack. I shouldn't have been backpacking in that.
Oh, yeah.
I shouldn't have been. Yeah. Like, I was utilizing it improperly at the best, you know.
I got one for you, just maybe to wrap this whole thing up and bring it back to the Appalachian Trail. I started the Appalachian Trail with a North Face water resistant jacket and pair of pants for rain gear.
Resistant, huh?
Because if you're not educated about such things,
DWR will get you every time.
You would think that water resistant sounds like rain gear.
Is it not?
Are you joking?
No, This has actually been one of my, I've been watching on social media recently, like these brands are like pushing these like, oh, it's a water, this jacket is a soft shell and it's water resistant. And I'm like, and they're like dropping, they're doing the whole beating up of water.
Oh man.
You know? Yeah. And I'm like, these poor people, they're going to think that these pants are, you know, the whole, they're hosing down the guy's leg with water.
Yeah.
And you're like, it's resistant. How long did it take you to figure out that you had made a mistake?
The first rainstorm.
You're like, this isn't working. Wet it out.
Am I soaking wet.
This is supposed to be resistant.
Why am I soaking wet? Yeah. Water resistant. That term should be banned. It's
waterproof
terrible.
Or it's not.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Even I would say waterproof is that also is a very relative term. Yeah. When I think of waterproof, I think of like a car tire or a glass bottle.
The rubber suit in Alaska. Dude, thank you so much for coming on. I really appreciate the conversation. Where would people go to get all the information on your guide trips? Where do you want people to go?
If someone searches for my name, the last name is Skurka, S-K-U-R-K-A, they would find me pretty easily. Cool. It's one of those distinct last names. Yeah, yeah,
I don't have much competition.
Yeah.
But it's your main website, right? That's where the guy is coming
out. Yeah, AndrewSkurka.com. Yeah.
Cool, man. Well, dude, I appreciate the conversation. Any last words or good to go?
No, thank you very much, Emery. It's been a pleasure.
All right, that is it for episode 153 with Andrew Skurka. Thank you so much for tuning in. To follow up on anything we mentioned in this episode, I've included links to all of it in the show notes, so be sure to check those out when you have a chance. Before you go, if you have not introduced yourself, please do. I love hearing from you guys, and I respond to all emails, so please hit me up anytime you like, even if you just want to say hi, at emery@byland.co. That's it for me. If you're headed out on an adventure anytime soon, be safe, make great decisions, and we'll see you next time.